This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Stories outside of the cafe.
That's a good idea.
Right. And so so why would people come then? Because it's I also read it's not really a therapy group or a bereavement group. You know, so what is really the purpose of this?
Karen, you might want to...
Well, I know the reason that I came, and I also know a few of the other participants, and I know that the question that I posed at my table is, other than the logistics of how you got there, where you read about it or where you heard about it, what wasn't working for you that you would show up on a Sunday afternoon that was a lovely Sunday afternoon in the midst of your day to talk about death? And sure enough, those things came up at the table. The things that people had deep grief about that hadn't worked. And a lot of times until people are in a situation with a family member or themselves, we can live a long time in our culture without ever thinking or talking about death, without ever welcoming it to our table, I like to say.
Yeah.
Giving it a place to sit down and a place in our life. And so... I came because for the last several years, I've been a student of a school in Ontario, Canada. And in this school, we are learning the skill of living deeply and dying well.
Uh-huh.
And so my want in coming to the Death Cafe is that we begin to have a different kind of conversation about death. In other words, we can talk about death. And my experience has been is that the majority of the time that we do that, it's within the context of the cultural phobia that we're born into.
Cultural phobia. I definitely want to get into that. I also want to let listeners know, if you want to call in and talk with any of the speakers here, the phone number at KBOO is 503-231-8187. And maybe we can have a little Death Cafe here on the radio. But basically, that's a lot of it. There is a cultural phobia. I mean, there's a kind of a taboo. My mother doesn't want to ever go to even a nursing home, or not a nursing home, but an independent living facility. It's where elephants go to die. And it's like to be reminded that you might be dying, or that you, even when you're getting really old in your 80s, that you might die. It's just like such this shutting off taboo thing.
Right.
Could you guys address that a little?
I feel like there's the silence around death and the discouraging from talking about it, but then we also go to great lengths to hide all evidence that we're going to die, just in our culture with our obsession with looking young and with sending old people away to or sick people away so it's out of view, whereas in other cultures and throughout history, death is a part of life that you see, and you grow up seeing it and knowing that it's part of your life, you know, and here I feel like we just hide it until it's too late, kind of, to have time to process it. I feel like
the terror of it.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that one of the big things that Kate just said is to speak of that it's not human to fear death. It's cultural.
Right.
And so a lot of times with Western culture, we come to things as though they're human, when they're actually not. And so we never ask the question of how did it get to be the way that it is. And so to me, that's one of the places that it's mandatory for us to go if we're going to have a conversation about this, and it's going to take us in a direction other than the one that we've been going in. It's mandatory to begin to ask the question of how did it get to be this way? And there are answers to that question.
We have two callers actually already. Elizabeth, would you like to ask a question?
Assistance, dial your operator.
Oh, okay. John, what would you like to ask?
Hi, great topic, and sounds like a great group of people to meet. And my question is, because Americans seem to have a lot of fear about death, and I think it's really great that we're talking about it. And what if someone gets angry because they have faith, whatever it is, in the hereafter, and people won't accept that, other people in the discussion group.
At a death cafe, you mean?
Right. They don't see that that's going to happen. I'm an agnostic.
Right.
So, yeah. But I'm just, you know, like somebody of a particular faith, whether it be Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I said, one of the core principles of Death Cafe is not trying to guide anyone to a particular conclusion or outcome. And I found when the Death Cafe came together that people, just by being able to talk about these things, people felt free and unguarded. And I would be surprised to see anger come up, but I'm sure all feelings come up around death. But it feels like such a welcoming and supportive environment. And in my small group that I was in, there were some very different opinions about death, and everyone talked about it respectfully, and I think we all came out away from it, you know, knowing more and understanding each other more.
So people would respect other people's beliefs.
That's probably part of your ground rules.
Yeah.
And
it sounds good, because I imagine if a person does get angry, the group could say, well, maybe you ought to take a break.
Yeah, there's also... Oh, I'm sorry. We also had some people with counseling experience available to help if anyone did have hard feelings come up or felt like they needed to talk to somebody. We were able to offer that, too.
I'd like to switch now to Elizabeth. Are you still on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, what would you like to ask?
Hi there. I just wanted to call in support of the Death Cafe and the wonderful women who were there on your panel. I was a participant in the cafe. I am a small town local funeral provider and a home burial advocate. And I was there, and also to talk to the man who was just on the phone. You know, my participation in the cafe was really to bring that sacred conversation of death forward. And I found that people were very, not really timid to be there. We sat in small groups. It was very affable with food, what have you. And we were really at a place of, there was a myriad of people. I would say half of us were actually death professionals who worked in hospice or worked in some sort of scope of counseling, bereavement, maybe, you know, worked as a funeral provider, what have you. The others of us were people who were just there to learn and to talk. And I found that the openness and the flow of the room and the conversation, there was a lot of laughter, a lot of kindness. And the table I specifically sat at, all four of us had a different religious upbringing and marking on our youth and our young adulthood, and all of us at this point had a different imprint now of what we practice and what we believe. Yet it was a really fine conversation. I found that it flowed. We all shared. We originally sat and introduced ourselves and just found from there it was a really natural flow. And for a while, I was looking around at other tables too. Same thing. I think everybody felt this sacred container and this real ease set of, hey, I'm in a safe space. I can actually speak. I can talk. This is expanding my own thought. I'm learning different ideas about
it. That sounds great. It sounds like, and so like there wasn't then a sense of it being morbid. I mean, could some of you address that?
I just wanted to say that there was a survey that most of the participants filled out and turned back in, and some words that were used to describe the Death Cafe experience, their experience: heartwarming, deep, transgressive, crucial, fascinating, intimate, practical, safe, sweet, useful, and connecting. And I think that says a lot, that those words all do sound, fit with my experience, and it didn't feel morbid, strangely.
I think that people tend to come to this conversation in our day and time as though it's a relief. I'm an undergrad student at Merrillhurst, and I often find in classes that this topic is right underneath the surface. And if you just welcome it in, it's there, and people are wanting
to
this
understand.
Conversation.
And what exactly is the conversation then? It's like I can imagine, okay, someday I am going to take my very last breath in, my breath out, and then I'm not going to breathe in again. Is it just get that sort of... Or what exactly do you talk about?
I was just going to say, I came to this as a gardener. And what does it mean that you've had a breath to take? You know, beyond any religion, beyond any psychology, there's a story to this place that we live. And if you're a gardener, you understand that the life cycle of your plants happens before your very eyes. And so how do we live as though that's true for us as people also? And how do we live as though we have dead that paved the way for us to even be here?
Yeah.
And what happens when it's our turn? Do we cling so that we're not part of that cycle? Or do we begin to understand what's been feeding us all along? And I mean that both poetically and also logistically.
Uh-huh.
How closely, when you really begin to study this topic, it's tied into absolutely everything. How closely does it mimic what we know about our food?
Right.
Where does our food come from? How does that happen? What's fed us in that way?
Right. Everything has to die to sustain this life, and then eventually this life goes and hopefully is sustaining something else.
The person that I study with has sat with 800 to 1,000 people as they've died, and he said that people in the get-go believe that their big fear is pain. Uh-huh. In the end, they wonder what we'll do with them after they're gone.
Wow.
And that's a big, big disconnect in how this actually all goes.
Right. I just want to let listeners know you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm speaking with three women, Kate Brasington, Holly Pruitt a little bit with her laryngitis, and Karen Pauly, who are all participants and organizers of Portland's first ever Death Cafe, which happened last month in April. And that's really interesting to me, this whole idea that, yeah, they go from being afraid of the pain to kind of just really anxious about how their bodies, I guess, are going to be used once they're dead. And I know, like, there's other things, too. My aunt, when she was dying, I was with her. Suddenly, she was someone who was sort of a materialist, and suddenly she's looking around her room on the bed where she died, looking at all the stuff from Gumps and this and that and the other. Stephanie, it's all just things. It's just things. And it was so remarkable to me that she just had this insight that things didn't seem to matter anymore, you know.
I would extend what you just said about worrying about what we'll do with their body to what we'll do with them. In
uh-huh.
other words, switch places with, put yourself on the other side of how we describe our dead. One of the most common terms that we use is that we've lost someone. And now
right.
imagine yourself being the one who's been lost.
Oh, wow.
This is cultural. This is not human.
Right. Or they've passed away. Or there is such a sense of, and actually my experience with people who have died is they're gone, you know. And
that's
been,
cultural.
Uh-huh.
That's not human.
Uh-huh.
If I could go back to what you were saying about what we talk about.
Right.
And in line with what Karen was saying, one of the most common things that people say at our death cafe, at all the death cafes, is that the conversation turns from being about death to what am I going to do with my life? What is it, you know, like you were saying, what does this that I'm dying mean for my life? And it becomes a very life-affirming, hopeful, inspiring discussion, you know? And then another thing I wanted to say was just when sort of about the people getting angry or that stuff. I find that when people get to talk about death, all the differences kind of melt away because that's when we're all the same.
Exactly.
Nothing else matters when you like you and me are both going to die. And so what's important now, you know, now knowing that, and it's not any differences in beliefs. You know.
I agree with what Kate's saying, and I would also put the extension on that our grief over when you imagine the day that you won't wake up and take a breath here with the people that you've loved,
right.
Our grief is our kinship with literally every human being on the planet.
Right.
And so there is that place, there is that commonality that comes to play in a moment in when we're sitting and talking about this.
Knowing that someday you're going to say goodbye to everybody. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just you. Goodbye to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that they also will be saying goodbye to you.
Right.
And it feels very lonely when you think of it like that. Like, I'm alone leaving this world. But then I think another bonus of talking about death a lot is that you realize, no, this is the only thing that I'm with everybody on. We're all doing this together. There are very few things that you can say that about.
Right,
you know?
Right. The commonality of it is huge. Yes, yes. And, I mean, there is definitely going to be another Death Cafe then, it sounds like,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. We are planning one for Sunday, June 30th, and then there will be another one in late September and a sort of holiday one early December. And so, we're really excited about all of them.
So that's excellent. And people could find out more about Death Cafes?
Right. We have a Facebook group. Do I say the URL?
Or I don't know how that works. Facebook.
Oh, yeah. That's email. Just search PDX Death Cafe. And the Facebook group, actually, that's the first thing that comes up. And,
And where did the Death Cafes actually start then? You said they started in Europe?
Uh-huh. There was a Swiss sociologist, I think, who was sort of, he organized them based on, I believe, like ancient Greek, you know, how they'd have the politics cafes and the science cafes or something like that. And then they used to have a death cafe, and then he made one. And then there's a man in England who sort of brought it into the English language and made it. Death Cafe.
And this was back like in 2004 or something.
I'm not sure on the. Yeah. And then the first one in the United States was in Columbus, Ohio, this last year.
Just this last year.
Mm-hmm, and it's spreading all over. You can see, if you go to www.deathcafe.com, you can learn about the whole worldwide movement, and they have upcoming death cafes. So if you're not in the area, there might be one in your area.
Yeah, I saw like that sometimes they do them even in cemeteries.
I didn't see that. That's funny.
Yeah. But the ones that you're doing, are you going to keep doing it at the Bijou Cafe?
We're looking for locations. Yeah, we have a few good ideas, really good ideas, but it's possible that it would be back at the Bijou Cafe. But that'll be announced.
So and getting back to just the philosophy of all this again. Do you think that a lot of the reason that there is this taboo and stuff and the culture of it, you know, with the U.S., that has to do with just fear of dying or just a kind of pervasive fear in the culture at large?
That's a huge topic because the way that we've approached it in the school is historically, and to keep continuing to go not back in history but into. And it's a large conversation. Historically, people made it to these shores in this country when they came here because they were on the run from really often horrible circumstances.
Right.
And I didn't really understand that fully until I began to look into the history of my family coming here during the potato famine in Ireland. And that's indeed. And you begin to forget where you came from. And then you begin to forget your people. And once you've forgotten your people and you've forgotten where you've come from, then death becomes a terrifying circumstance.
Why would that be then? What do you mean?
Well, if we are indeed not individuals and we are indeed a collective culture of people, and we've made ourselves segmented into individual people walking around, then it becomes terrifying when you die because you're dying alone. If you're dying in a collective culture, I can tell you in the traveling that I've done, when I have been to India, I've stood on the banks of the Varanasi on the Ganges River, and I've watched people come through the streets being carried on stretchers with silk coverings over the top of them, and then they're taken down to the banks of the river, and they're put onto sandalwood, and they're burned, and everyone's there to watch. And when the body has burned, the oldest son cracks the skull open. These are things that I've watched happen. When you die in a culture like that, you know what will happen for you when you die. When you die in Bali, you know that there will be a big procession, a funeral procession in the streets, and you know that every so many days you'll be remembered as a person. And imagine the difference between that and being lost.
Right, right. You feel the sense of connection, the sense of kind of going on in a way.
So I back to what I was saying, when we came here, we became homeless.
Right.
And we became unrooted from those traditions and from our people. So what I was just describing was what it looks like when you have a people, and what we have here is very descriptive of what it looks like when you don't.
Right. So, and there's just it sounds like what you're describing is a sense of being just tremendously more lonely to die here than it would be in a place like in India or back in Ireland or...
But we all come from those traditions that are intact.
Right.
We all have people who were indigenous to somewhere. So then it becomes the work of how do you begin to put that back together? How do you begin to remember that? Because we pretty much walk around as though we don't have any indigenous roots.
And is that your sense then of one of the roles that the Death Cafe could play is sort of recreating that for us?
Yeah, I don't think it could play that role specifically, but I think... getting the conversation going, and then maybe that would inspire people to find a greater connection to their ancestors and their roots. And just the more, I think the more you know you're dying, then and the longer you have to get used to the idea that you're dying,
right.
the better,
right.
you know. And the more, like the scene you were describing with on the Ganges, I've been there, and the thing is, it's not just a river for that. There's people brushing their teeth, and the kids are playing, and the everyone is around, and there's these death processions right in the middle of it, and so it's all part of life. It's not put away separately, so it's not so scary, and so the Death Cafe similarly could make it part of our conversation that we have as people, as a community.
And to bring it out,
to bring out
like more, you're not stuck in a box, hidden in a black
right.
hearse, and then disappeared. Maybe we would have. When my father died, I actually stayed. I stayed next to him that night. I mean, he died in a bed, and then I was sort of nearby on a bed, right next to him,
yeah.
and it was weirdly comforting. The rest of the night, it was very, very comforting in some strange way, and to sort of have that be a part of. What we're willing to do again.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And if I can whisper in here.
Go for it, Holly.
One of the words that was most commonly used when we debriefed afterwards was intimate. People found it to be an extraordinarily intimate conversation to speak with strangers. We asked them not to sit at a table with anyone they knew. And people often said that they had deeper conversations, more honest conversations with strangers than they could have with the people in their families. And so the cafe really does offer an opportunity to connect across divides.
That's incredible. Yeah. And did you find that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so then basically, it sounds like a death cafe. It's a good thing. There'll be another one June 30th,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like something to really bring people out for, to like get us used to the fact. And who knows, maybe we're all, you know, the climate crisis and everything else, we might be all going together at some point,
right.
you know.
Could I add sure. one thing real quick? That Holly is, we are trying to organize help for people who want to start their own death cafe. So maybe they don't want to come to ours. Maybe they live in Gresham or in Hillsborough, and we're trying to encourage people also to start their own death cafes.
Right. These are definitely spreading,
yeah.
it sounds like.
Yes.
So they just check PDX, just Google PDX Death Cafe, right? And you're going to be able to find out everything you want to know about it. Okay, well, I just want to say, does anybody have a last thought, quick?
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Oh, you're totally welcome. And I want to let the listeners know you've been listening to KBOO Portland. I've been speaking with life cycle celebrant Holly Pruitt and Kate Brasington, who organized and hosted Portland's first ever Death Cafe last April. And Karen Polly was one of the 60 people who participated. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. Kurt, thanks for your great engineering, and thanks all of you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 11:29. Coming up at 11:30, host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with local mural artists and creative space advocates Eno Bonza, Tomas Vallardis, and Tiffany Conklin of the Portland Street Art Alliance.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help sponsor the Triangle production version of Ave Maria, a musical about the 20th century's most famous Greeks, Aristotle Onassis and Maria Callas, starring Bruce Blanchard and Amy Jo Holliday. The musical will take place at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Ave Maria runs from May 2nd to May 26th. More information and tickets may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Sidewalk playgrounds got to beware. Junkman's in the shadows dealing his junk. Beautiful sisters deal themselves around. Beautiful brothers not so beautiful anymore. So much older than the day before. Ain't everybody tired of being poor? Graffiti man's got something to say. Message in the scrawl, message on the wall. Something's wrong, not our fault. We gotta be cool. Our time will come.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland. What should the role of public art be in the city of Portland? How should public art, including murals and graffiti, be regulated? My guests for this half hour have considered these questions very carefully. They are all interested in art in public spaces. With us is Bonzo, a local mural artist and creative space advocate. Welcome, Bonzo.
Thank you.
Also here is Tomas Valladares. He is an arts administrator and co-founder of the Portland Street Art Alliance. Welcome, Tomas.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Tiffany Conklin, who is co-founder of the Portland Street Art Alliance and a PSU researcher. Welcome, Tiffany.
Great, thanks.
I'd like to ask each of you to talk a little about your background and interest in this area as a way to get started in this conversation. So, Bonzo, can you talk a little bit about what you do and how it relates to this?
Absolutely. I have been an active mural artist for a number of years and engaging in creative space advocacy, which is trying to take maybe those unused, forgotten places in this city and turning them into something that the community can celebrate. And I've worked in a number of different states that have, you know, deregulated their walls and just have a lot of open space. And it's all about just working with those private neighborhoods and getting something really beautiful up. And until I came to Portland, I didn't really realize that there could be a problem with trying to do this or that we could be restricted in our access to public space. So that's a little bit of where I'm coming from.
And what brought you to Portland?
What brought me to Portland is just that Portland is absolutely beautiful, and I had family out here, had been visiting for a number of years. This is just a wonderful city as far as art, architecture, history goes.
Great. Tomas, how about you?
Well, I've always loved street art in all its forms, and I have a documentary background, so I've always loved taking photos and videos and kind of got into enjoying public art in that way, and being in Portland, able to meet a lot of the artists and a lot of that community here, and I've built a nice community and started getting into that some more advocacy in that way.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Tiffany Conklin, your interest and background in this area.
Yeah, I'd say it probably started after visiting Europe and seeing the amazing street art on their streets there and kind of seeing how little we had here in the U.S., especially in cities where I was from, Tampa, Florida, and then here in Portland. And then I finished a master's in urban studies at PSU, so I chose to focus on public space for that. So, just really interested in issues of public space and ensuring that everybody has equal access to those spaces.
And how did the whole issue, or the whole organization, the Portland Street Art Alliance, did I say that correctly? Portland Street Art Alliance, yes. How did that come about?
So me and Tomas met last year, and in the fall of 2012, we realized that, a lot of our friends were echoing a lot of the same things and concerns that we were thinking, why is it so difficult to make art in the streets in Portland, and why can't we have more? So we thought that we could probably help the community come together and voice some of those concerns to the larger public. And instead of just always kind of being in crisis mode after we saw incidents happen, that maybe we could just be a little bit more prepared and proactive with these things and trying to, disseminate some information and gather up some research and, kind of collect everybody's voices together.
And it's a website. And what else is the Portland Street Art Alliance?
Well, the Portland Street Art Alliance, it's a group of artists, academics, professionals, and we believe that street art is really important to a vibrant and creative and dynamic city, and we think Portland is that. And basically, we promote creative interventions in public space.